name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 87. I'm recording it on Friday, January 30th, 2009. The P10 level today is 14. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for this podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. And the title of the selection used on this podcast is Awesome Call. The title of the podcast is Fear of Litigation Caused Our Economic Crisis. Holy moly! Fear of litigation caused our economic crisis? I don't think I've seen that written up anywhere else. I'm a reporter by trade, and I'm always looking for a news story. That's what excites reporters. And I don't think I've seen anyone else attribute the economic crisis we're living through today to a fear of litigation. But I saw an article this morning. I make the rounds of the internet in the morning. I probably spend too much time on it. But I saw an article, and it wasn't in the investing section. You know, sometimes you have to go outside of the normal sources of information to find the real story. This was an article about security on your computer, how to determine a password. And the guy made an argument that surprised me a little bit, but after reading it, it made sense to me, especially when I thought of a comparable situation that I'll bring up in my own description. He said that the rules that we are told to come up with to handle password security on our computers are not necessarily the best rules. And I think we all know what these rules are. We're told don't use any words that are in the dictionary as your password. Combine letters and numerals. Combine uppercase and lowercase. You know, never use your birthday or your dog's name or whatever. And never write down your password. And change it every month. Change your password every month or so. Now, those rules, obviously, they do a good job of creating security. That's certainly true. If you follow those rules, it will be very hard for hackers to break into your computer. Excuse me. The guy who wrote the article did not dispute that. And I certainly don't dispute it. But he made the kind of argument that appeals to me. It's called a common sense argument. I love it when people bring common sense into a discussion. That just turns me on. And this guy said, okay, these are rules for having a safe password. That much is certainly true. But is there a little bit of a common sense problem? How many people out in the world actually do this? Come up with these complicated passwords that no human mind could possibly remember. You know, small a, numeral 7, capital Z, numeral 3, numeral 6, capital P, small n, question mark. You know, that's going to be your computer password. Now, you're not allowed to write it down. One of the rules is you can't write it down on a piece of paper, because if you write it down on a piece of paper, the computer hack, he might look in your wallet. He might have access to your wallet, or he might look in your desk drawer. So if you write it in your desk drawer, if you write it on a yellow sticky, or if you write it in your wallet, but there's virtually zero chance you're going to remember it. It's impossible to remember such a password. And in the event that you had a photographic memory and you were able to remember it, you'd have to change it in a month. And then you'd have to try to remember the new one. What the fellow was saying in the article is that our rules for coming up with computer passwords are nuts. From one way of looking at things, the standpoint of we want ultimate security, they make perfect sense. They're logical, but they don't work in the real world. This is the subtitle of the book I'm writing on investing. How to get what works on paper to work in real life. This guy's telling us the rules by which we come up with passwords to protect our computers from hackers work on paper. On paper, they sound great. They pass every test, but they don't work in the real world. He said, what does everyone do? Most people follow different procedures, but most people follow the rules in terms of developing the password. They do the thing with the mixing numerals and upper and lower case and not using words from the dictionary. But, because that sort of thing can be checked. If you have a password at your place of business and something goes wrong with your computer and you have to tell the computer security person what your password was, if you give your dog's name, my password is Snowflake, they're going to know you didn't follow the rules. You're a bad boy or a bad girl. So he said most people follow that part. But they can't really check on whether you've scribbled it down on a piece of paper and stuck it in your desk, or scribbled it down on a piece of paper and stuck it in your wallet. So that's what most people do. Most people try to follow the rules. We're not bad people. We don't want to break the rules. But we know darn well we can't remember that password if we don't write it down somewhere, especially if we're going to change it every month. So we scribble it down on a piece of paper, and we hope that the bad guys don't get a hold of the piece of paper. So we're all playing a little game. We're pretending to follow the rules. We're pretending to be good little boys and good little girls. And the company is pretending to want to protect our computers. They're pretending to give us advice that's helpful. But everybody knows it's a game. Everybody knows we're really scribbling the passwords down on a piece of paper somewhere. Most of us. And of course, the hackers know that. So, if the hackers are able to get into your desk drawer and get that computer, well, there goes system security. Or if they're able to get into your wallet, there goes system security. They break in. But the game goes on. We all pretend. Everybody knows what's going on, and everybody pretends they don't. There's a parallel to Investo World. As a parallel to passive investing. But first, let me tell you what hit me when I read this article. I read this article about computer password security, and I said, this guy's on to something, because I said, what does this remind me of? Going to the doctor. He went into why they did this. He went into why they have these crazy rules for passwords. The rules aren't crazy in a sense. You see, I have this struggle when talking about passive investing. I'll say it's crazy, it's insane. Passive investing can never work. And then I'll pull back a little bit and I'll say, well, it's not really insane. There is an internal logic there. It's just like the computer password thing. It's insane only if you want it to work. If you want the advice to work, passive investing can never work in the real world. It's been tested 4 times. It's every single time in history it's been tried. It's brought bone-crushing losses to everyone who followed it. It can never work. But there is an internal logic to it, and it's the same internal logic that there is to the password security rules. What's going on is that we're using our brains to come up with these rules, but we're using only that part of our brain that is logic, and we're leaving out common sense. And when you leave out common sense, what you come up with is not practical, and if it's not practical, it doesn't actually work. And, you know, to some of us, that's a problem. We'd like our investing advice to actually work. That's the revolution I'm calling for in the switch from passive investing to rational investing. I'm trying to develop investing ideas that stand a realistic chance of actually working. Imagine. Now, the guy, he explained, I didn't know this. He said the reason why they come up with these rules is because of, it's strange the way things play out in the world. It's because of the Enron disaster. Remember Enron? Some company, and everybody lost tons of money. And I think that was that the end? It was the end of one of the big accounting firms. I don't know if it was Arthur Anderson. That's the one I'm thinking. But I'm not sure it was Arthur Anderson involved there, but it might well have been. One of the big accounting firms that did the audit for Enron. And so they were just buried, you know, I guess in lawsuits or something. But the guy was saying Congress passed legislation to, you know, and of course, I'm sure they did this with good intent. You see, this comes up all the time in the passive investing matter. Rob's saying, oh, they made all these mistakes. Rob is a meanie. Rob's saying they're all bad people. And I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is people do things with good intent, but they make mistakes. And then the mistakes cause these devastating consequences. And then the people can't admit the mistakes because the consequences are so devastating. And it just goes on and on and on. We get deeper and deeper and deeper into it. So the Enron thing was a disaster in itself, but there was legislation passed so that there would never be another Enron. Never be another Enron. We've got Enron times 500 today. We're all living through today, but there would never be another Enron. But anyway, the legislation said that the CEOs of companies can be held liable if their auditing standards fail or their accounting standards fail, something like this. I think they were making the CEO liable. I guess the idea was, you know, the CEO of Enron, they weren't able to hang him up from a tree, so they had to pass legislation. You see, I'm I don't mean to get off on a tangent, but I just think it's a mistake to always worry about hanging people from a tree. That's not my thing. Sometimes it's appropriate, but it's sometimes misplaced energy to worry about that sort of thing. What we need to do is fix things for ourselves, fix things for our own best interest, and don't worry so much about hanging people from a tree. That's just my general inclination. So they made CEOs liable. So what he's saying is when the CEOs became liable, well, the CEO, that legally these provisions could apply to the rules that they give on computer security. That if somebody, you know, obviously if somebody breaks into your computer, you may suffer financial losses. The CEOs don't want to be liable for that. So they had to come up with a way to get themselves off the hook. So they have standards, and the standard, you know, lawyers draft these things. So they go to the lawyers and they say, you know, what sort of password security rules should I have that'll protect me so I don't get sued, so I don't lose the wealth of a lifetime, you know, accumulated wealth of a lifetime. And the lawyers say, well, you know, let's stay up all night and figure out rules that'll make it these passwords super safe. So they've got to, you know, they can't use words in the dictionary. They've got to mix up letters and numerals. They've got to have an uppercase, lowercase. They've got to change it every month. They can't write it down. The lawyers are doing their job. The regulators did their job. The CEO's doing his job. Everybody's doing their job. The communications person in your company who tells you the rules is doing his job. The tech people who make sure you follow the rules, who turn you in if you break any of them. They're doing their job. The guy sitting at his computer who's got to come up with these passwords, he's doing his job. But somehow you got to remember the password or you can't get back onto your computer. So you write it down on a piece of paper. You violate the one rule so that life can continue. And of course, the hacker's doing his job. The hacker knows that's what everybody's doing. So the hacker knows what he has to do to break into the system. Whereas if we used, you know, the guy writing the article was basically arguing, you know, you obviously don't want a simple password. It's probably not a great idea to make Snowflake your password. But his point is, you know, you could mix it up a little bit and still have a password you could remember and not have to write it down, and that might be a better approach. Now, I don't know if that's a better approach. I haven't studied the matter. Doesn't seem like a crazy idea to me. Seems like there might be something to that. The idea of writing down our passwords and keeping them in our wallet seems like a dubious proposition, and I really don't see what else you can do if you're going to come up with a hard-to-remember password and then change it every month. So the point here is the lawyers came up with these rules. It's a fear of litigation that drives this password creation rule industry. Whatever you want to call it. It's true with doctors, isn't it? I have something called celiac disease, which means I can't eat wheat. So I can't have any more Tony's pizza. I remember one time I was on a thread at Vanguard Diehards and somebody was talking about John Bogle, and I said, "Hey, I said if I run into John Bogle at that Vanguard Diehards annual meeting, I'm going to invite John Bogle to Tony's place back in Northeast Philadelphia, and we're going to have a tomato pie." And if you haven't had a tomato pie, you just don't know. You just don't know what you're missing. But I've never seen them anywhere, but where I grew up, Northeast Philadelphia, I'm sure they exist other places, but I've never seen them. And that's my favorite pizza my whole life, and every time I go back to visit my mother, I'd have a Tony's pie. I can eat one by myself, you know. But I just inhale them. But they're fantastic. And it has the tomato on the top rather than the cheese on the top. It's somewhat different kind of pizza, but thin crust. But now I've got this thing called celiac, which means I can't eat wheat. It causes stomach upset. But I've never been diagnosed officially because, you know, I just don't want to go in for all these tests. They've got to charge me all this money. So I just read a book and, you know, self-diagnosed it and stopped eating gluten. And that seems to solve the problem. But the point is, you've got to... These doctors, and my mother does the same thing. She's elderly, and, you know, she should be going to the doctor and having things checked. And a lot of times she says, "I don't want to go, because if I go, he'll check my heart." They always check your heart or your blood pressure or whatever. And if there's anything a little bit off, he's going to put me in the hospital because he doesn't want to get sued. And I don't want to go to the hospital, you know, unless I really need to be in the hospital. So the doctor's doing his job. But my mother's doing her job, too. She just doesn't go to the doctor. That's not a good thing. But everybody's following the rules. But the rules were made by lawyers. So what I'm trying to say is, in a lot of fields of human endeavor today, it's the lawyers who are controlling. Now, I'm a lawyer. I went to law school. So I'm not biased against lawyers. But there's a place for this hyper-technicality. Another example of it that is a pet peeve of mine, if you go to the Morningstar boards, you know, all these boards have rules for what can be permitted. And they have good rules at Morningstar, but then they have this language. They started off saying, the conversations here are held for entertainment purposes only. And you know darn well that a lawyer came up with that. And so whenever you complain about abusive posting, someone will say, you know, I complain not just about abusive posting, but, you know, false statements, demonstrably false claims about safe withdrawal rates. People cite the old school studies. And these numbers are demonstrably false. You can check. They don't include an adjustment for valuations. If you adjust for valuations, you get a different number. Larry Swedrow says they're garbage in, garbage out. But if you object, people will say, hey, there's nothing wrong with using smear campaigns to drive anyone off the board who reports that these numbers are wrong, because, hey, it's for entertainment purposes only. We don't have to give accurate information here. It's for entertainment purposes only. The only trouble is 95% of the people reading the board don't know that for entertainment purposes only means that the information on retirement planning is wrong, that accurate reporting of the retirement numbers has been prohibited effectively. They don't know that, that little detail. That little bit of language, I suppose, is supposed to, you know, it's, I presume it's there to give them legal protection so that, that, you know, they can allow smear campaigns, which means allowing garbage in, garbage out retirement studies. But they can't, you know, they don't want to be held liable. So if somebody says, well, my retirement failed because they wouldn't allow me, you know, I use this board to learn about retirement planning, and every time I ask a question, they refer me to these old school studies, and I would have known my retirement failed because I used one of those studies, and if the board had been open to honest posting on retirement planning, I would have known my retirement wouldn't have failed. And they didn't do anything. They didn't enforce their rules against abusive posters. You know, presumably what will happen is the lawyer will say, oh, didn't you read entertainment purposes only? See, this is how the hyper-technicality of lawyers gets us into trouble. We can't live life thinking about lawyers every second. There's a time we obviously need law, you know, we need a law, and to interpret law, we need lawyers. I certainly don't say different, but lawyers can't be deciding every little decision we're going to make. And this, you know, it's a problem with doctors, it's a problem with medical advice. A lot of doctors want to help us, and they can't. Because if they say something, they're not sure. You know, if they say something that's not in a book, they could get in trouble. They could get sued. And so what they're told is don't ever say anything that's not in the book. Don't answer questions. Don't volunteer information. Never fail to take a test. And if you can't afford the test, you know, too bad for you. Don't go to the doctor. That's the practical consequence of this super legalization, is that a lot of people don't go to doctors that should. But you can't get sued for that, you see. The doctor doesn't get sued if you don't go to him. He only gets sued if you ask him a question and he gives an answer where maybe, you know, it's not written up in a book, but he's seen evidence and he believes it and he's telling you, you know, the best that he knows. It's affecting doctors, and it's affecting computer security people, and it's affecting investing advice. It's affecting investing advice. The big question that we always talk about at PassionSaving.com is, if passive investing has been discredited by nearly 30 years of academic research, and it has been, I'm a reporter, I'm not an investing expert, but I know how to follow links, I know how to search on Google. I read you in a podcast just a few back what Jeremy Grantham says about the efficient market theory. So listen to that one if you have any doubts about whether the efficient market theory has been discredited and passive investing is just the practical manifestation of the efficient market theory. Excuse me. So, you know, the whole premise of all the investing ideas presented at PassionSaving.com is that passive investing doesn't work, been discredited, 30 years of research, lots of experts say that valuations affect long-term returns. Common sense tells us this. Historical data tells us this, confirms it. But it can't be said. Rob Bennett discovered that the old school studies, the old school retirement studies, are analytically invalid. They don't include an adjustment for valuations. And I said this at a Motley Fool discussion board, and I was banned. I was removed because I said this. Even though I'm able to cite experts who agree with me, even though I'm able to point to the historical data that confirms what I say, even though common sense tells us that it must be so. It's an incredible story, but it's all true. And I wasn't banned just at one board. I was banned at Morningstar.com. I was banned at Bogleheads.org. I was banned at Early Retirement Forum. I was banned at Financial Webring Forum. I was banned at IndexUniverse.com. Never have I put forward an abusive post in my life. Never will. I don't believe in it. But I did report the safe withdrawal rate accurately. Now, you know, it's like we're on Mars having this discussion. How could it be? It can't be a conspiracy, right? There's zero chance that the head of Motley Fool got together with the head of Morningstar, and they got together with the head of Early Retirement Forum, and they all got together in a room and they said, "Hey, let's all ban Rob Bennett. Let's get him." You know, he likes Bob Dylan, and Bob Dylan is Nowheresville, man. That's old stuff. That's like baby boomer stuff. Let's ban this guy. That didn't happen. So what's the motive? You know, why? If you can understand why that happened, you understand how stock investing got so messed up in the 1990s. How prices went to such insane levels that it caused, well, at least the second worst economic crisis we've ever seen, and there's a chance it's going to become the worst. The biggest loss of middle class wealth in U.S. history. If you can understand why all these people acted the way they did, you'll understand. So why did they act that way? Well, you know, I think there's more than one answer, and I addressed that question in other podcasts. Things like cognitive dissonance and the thought that investing had become scientific, even though it, you know, had become partly scientific, but not fully so just yet. And, you know, the emotions that people feel during a bull market. There are different factors. But a big factor, I believe, a significant factor, is this concern over litigation. Now, think about it for a second. We're talking about doctors being afraid of litigation, and, you know, quite rightly so. Obviously, why are doctors afraid of litigation? Because what the work they do is so important. If you go to a doctor, and you know, I mean, if you go to a, let me think of an example, of something that's not so significant. There's lawsuits in just about everything today, but, you know, people always bring up the lawsuit against McDonald's. You know, somebody bought a cup of coffee and they spilled it in their lap and they sued. You know, they said, "You need to warn me that the coffee's hot." So now when you buy a cup of coffee at McDonald's, there's a thing on the side that says, "Caution, coffee is hot." You know, in case you didn't know, coffee is hot. Danger, danger, Will Robinson. They didn't used to have that. So ordinarily, you know, you might think that, you know, an establishment that sells coffee wouldn't have to worry about lawsuits. You would think that's, you know, as long as they don't put poison in the coffee, you would think they might be okay. But even that's not true. But doctors, it's easy to see why doctors are at risk of lawsuits. You know, if a doctor makes it, we all make mistakes. We're all human. This is a constant theme at PassionSaving.com. We're all human. We all make mistakes. Well, if you're a doctor and you make a mistake, you know, the person can die or the person can, you know, be put in a wheelchair. I had back surgery, you know, a long, long time ago, but, you know, that was the fear. I mean, if the doctor made a mistake, he could be paralyzed. Didn't happen, and I don't think it happens very often, but it can happen. So you can understand why there's a fear of lawsuits. Well, how about in investing? Investing's not a life or death matter. So in one sense, investing professionals, investing experts, investing advisors are not quite as at much are not at as much risk as doctors. But in another sense, they're at more risk because, well, first of all, everyone goes to investing advisors. Everyone goes to them. So they're everyone goes to doctors, but not that often. But investing advisors, we invest money, you know, every week, every paycheck. So the coverage is almost universal. Nobody really understands it all that well, you know. People think that experts understand investing. I question that based on what I've learned. So even the experts don't understand it all that well. You know, they understand what's in the books. Obviously, they, you know, I don't say they don't do their homework. They do their homework and they understand what's in the books, but the state of human knowledge is not all that terribly advanced. It's not a science. That's the point. If it were science, these people would be off the hook. All you'd have to do is say, here, it's a science, here's what the textbook says, and all the people I've known, I mean, I don't know all that many, but the ones I talk about on the podcast or write about at the site, they all know what's in the textbooks. I mean, that's just not even under question. So if all the answers were in a textbook, there'd be no risk. But the answers are not. The textbooks don't know. The people writing the textbooks don't know. There's things we just don't know, and there's also things that there's differences of opinion. So there is no right or wrong answer. But you've got to give an answer that what people want. People don't want to hear that there's no right or wrong answer. They want to know, what should I do? Just like when you're at a doctor, you can't really take a neutral position. You can't say, well, you know, it could be you need heart surgery, and if you don't have it, you'll die, but it could be you don't need it. You know, I mean, you know, that's not considered a good response. You know, obviously the doctor will say, I can't tell you 100%, but I think you need this. You know, he has to give you some sense of how grave the danger is. And of course the doctor will say, I don't even know you're going to survive the operation, but he has to give some idea. And there's always that risk of, you know, even if it's 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000, who die from the operation, if it happens to be your family member who's the one who died, you're going to be upset. And then if the doctor said, oh, the risk is very small, 1 in 1,000, well, they might get a lawsuit. But that 1 in 1,000 does come up. And the same thing's true in the investing area. If they give advice that they sincerely believe at the time they give it, and it doesn't work, And there's just no way to know for sure. And you can mention all these caveats and people don't necessarily take them to heart. You can get sued. The risk of lawsuit is probably even greater in the investing area, because in the investing area we're dealing with money and lawsuits are all about money. So that it translates really easy. And there's no area, you know, there's a point I make about the old school safe withdrawal rate studies all the time. It just drives me crazy that these studies haven't been corrected in 7 years after the errors were identified. But something about, I'm always trying to figure out why is that. Well, and there's a phrase I use. I'll say, these old school studies give numbers that are demonstrably false. I don't just say they're false. I say they're demonstrably false. That's the point I'm trying to make, is that they're the product of a mathematical calculation. How the heck can we not, how can it be that we live in a world where we can't get the mathematical calculation right? That just makes my head want to explode. You know, I've said many times, I've said, look, if John Graney or Mel Lindauer wants to be on a discussion board with Rob Bennett, and they want to say that they personally believe that a 4% withdrawal rate is always safe, I say, hey, you know, be my guest. You know, it's healthy to have John Graney say 4% is the safe withdrawal rate and Rob Bennett say it's 2%. And I can make my case and John can make his case and people can come to their own conclusion. That's healthy. That's good. That's a learning experience. But see, John doesn't say that. John says it's a scientific proof that it's 4%. He's got a study. He's got numbers. He says, Rob, if you don't understand it's 4%, you're mathematically incompetent. I am sort of mathematically incompetent, but he's saying something stronger than what I say. And he says, you're mental, dude. You need drugs. You need meds. If you think it's not 4%, it's a scientific study. But see, it's not. It's a scientific study that leaves out the most important factor. So the number's wrong. So the question is, why? Why is that controversial? Why can't that be admitted? Well, let's just think for a second. What would it mean if, say, Rob Bennett were king of the world? If Rob Bennett were king of the world, the old school studies would be corrected. And starting tomorrow, bright and early, all retirement studies would include an adjustment for valuations. Okay? Now, I do indeed think that would be a very, very good thing. It does not mean, if such a thing were to happen, it would not mean that everyone would agree with Rob Bennett. If you want to know what I think is the safe withdrawal rate, plug numbers into the retirement risk evaluator. That's a calculator at my website. And, you know, I worked on it with John Walter Russell. He did the statistical work. I asked the annoying questions. That's Rob Bennett's role in our partnership. And, we came up with a calculator, and I don't think it's perfect. I think people will find flaws in it if they look hard enough. I'd be grateful if they'd bring them to my attention. But it's the best job I could do. And John. And that John could do. And, that's that. Do I believe that if this law of the universe were passed, saying all retirement calculators from this point forward will include an adjustment for valuations, would everyone agree that the safe withdrawal rate is what I say it is and what John says it is? They would not. There are different methodologies that could be used. If you used, Bill Bernstein came up with a number very similar to ours. He said it was 2% at the top of the bubble. But Bill Bernstein, he didn't use PE10. He used the Gordon equation to account for valuations. Andrew Smithers, he believes valuations affect long-term returns. But he doesn't use the Gordon equation, and he doesn't use PE10. He uses something called Tobin's Q. So there are different valuation assessment tools. So it might be that you'd have different people calculating the safe withdrawal rate, and one would say it's 2%, and one would say it's 1.9%, and one would say it's 2.1%. What are you going to do? Well, my answer is, they should all say what they believe. As long as they're sincere, that's a good thing. So the people trying to find out what's safe will say, I don't know, there's three people who have studied it, and one said 1.9 and one said 2.1 and one said 2. It sounds like it's somewhere around 2, but I don't know. It might be 1.9, it might be 2.1. I don't know for sure. What's the benefit of that? The benefit of that is it's true. We don't know if it's 1.9 or 2.0 or 2.1. The entire investing community. There are differences of opinion. So the healthy thing, the honest thing, is that people be informed that we know it's somewhere around 2, but we don't know exactly what. Well, the old school studies don't say it that way. The old school studies say it's 4.0%. We are the robots. We are the investing expert robots, and we have determined it is 4.0%. Nothing less, nothing more. It's science, the capital S. Now, there's a fellow radiology doctor who I used to post with, and radiology doctor did a study aimed at determining whether the assumption used in the old school studies, how likely it is to come through. The assumption is that valuations for the first time in history will have zero effect on the long-term return. And a radiology doctor did a standard deviation analysis. He, you know, it's a complicated thing. You know, you'd have to understand statistics. And I don't understand it fully, but I get the drift. And he's trying to determine how likely it is that this assumption is going to come through. The answer is the odds are 1 in 740 that this will be the first time in history in which valuations will have zero effect. So the proper way to state the results of the old school studies is not the safe withdrawal rate is 4%. The proper way to say it is there's a 1 in 740 chance that the safe withdrawal rate is 4%. That's very different. It's a very different claim. What they did in the old school studies is they took the most outlandish possibility of all. You know, I could argue whether my assumptions are better than Andrew Smithers or my assumptions are better than Bill Bernstein. You could have reasonable differences of opinion on that question. But you can't have any reasonable difference of opinion that the old school studies take the most outlandish possibility imaginable. But see, that's why I say it's crazy. That's why I say it's analytically invalid. Why not take a reasonable assumption? Here's why. A reasonable assumption is going to lead to uncertainty. If you take the reasonable assumption that valuations are going to affect long-term returns, you're not really sure if the number is 3.9 or 4.1. You can't say. You can say your opinion. You can say, I think 3.9, because that's the methodology that makes sense. Or you can say 4.1. That's the methodology I prefer. But some are going to say 3.9, and some are going to say 4.1. Well, the legal people, the legal technical people don't like answers like that. They don't want the computer security police telling people, if you think you can remember the password, you know, use a word that's not in the English dictionary, but if you think you'd have to write it down to remember it, you're better using, you know, make part of your password, you know, an actual word. Maybe make your password snowflake 728 and change that once a month, but don't write it on a piece of paper. The computer police don't like that because there's a little bit of risk. You're taking a risk there. It's not the most obscure password possible. And so it doesn't make the legal people happy. But the CEO, his hands are tied. If he gives practical advice, he can get sued. The same thing's true in Investo world. If the investing experts were to give us practical advice, I think their fear is that they could get sued. If they were to tell us, the safe withdrawal rate's not 4%. Come on. Safe withdrawal rate varies, sometimes as low as 2%, sometimes as high as 9%. There's different methodologies that will cause different numbers. Maybe it's really 1.9%. If they give answers like that, you see, when they say 4.0, boy, it sure sounds like they know what they're talking about, doesn't it? Sounds like they've got their act together. They've read the studies. Oh, they've read the academic studies, and oh, they can cite them. They know the authors, and they know the year they came out, and they know what data they looked at, and they know what the number is. And they can answer. They can just ask them questions. They can spit out answers. No doubt, no uncertainty. They're experts. That's what it means to be an expert. Can't sue them. They're experts. They passed every test. The only problem with that sort of expertise is that it's wrong and that it causes millions of best at retirements. What I'm saying is we should give accurate answers, even if there's a little bit of vagueness, because we don't know precisely. So what I'll say is plug numbers into the retirement risk evaluator. If it comes up, you know, if the number comes up 2.4 for the valuation level that applies today, well, that's our best estimate as of today. If new information comes in, we'll change it. And if you go to someone else who uses a different valuation assessment tool, you may not get precisely the same answer. You may get 2.7 instead of 2.4. Them's the breaks. What I do is I say, I'll give you the best answer I can give you. You know, whatever my little brain is capable of coming up with, that's what I'll share with you. I won't tell you four, because that has no valuation adjustment, and my little brain isn't capable of imagining a way that could be true. But the legal system is unintentionally shuts down the practical common sense approach. The legal system drives people giving practical common sense investing advice out of business because they can be sued. And don't think I haven't been threatened. John Graney's threatened to sue me. I've told people that his retirement study's wrong. And he's threatened to sue me. And he has friends, you know, who have supported him. And that scares blogs. I go to blogs and I try to share the information we've learned in our community. And they're not too timid to let the blog owner know that if Rob Bennett gets sued, maybe they're going to get sued because they allowed Rob Bennett to speak. Mel Lindauer, he used to say, I mean, he used this word. I remember him saying it in a post. He said, Rob's investing advice is dangerous. You know, someone was saying, you know, Mel, why do you have to smear him every time? Why can't you just let people speak? Hundreds of people have indicated they'd like to hear what Rob has to say. Why do you have to have these smear campaigns? And Mel said, this advice is dangerous. We all have a responsibility to do something when somebody offers dangerous investing advice. But I was telling people to go with a lower stock allocation when prices were at insanely dangerous levels. Mel was saying you don't need to lower your stock allocation. Now we've suffered the biggest loss of middle class wealth in U.S. history. In this made up, artificial world of passive investing, Mel's advice was safe and Rob Bennett's was dangerous. In the real world, it's Mel Lindauer's advice that is dangerous. The idea of not changing your stock allocation when prices go to an insane levels is dangerous, irresponsible, reckless. And I say that knowing I could be sued. I don't like it. I don't think it should be so. I don't think there should be any risk that I would be sued for saying such a thing. And my hope, I'll say it a little more forthrightly now than I would before the price crash, because my hope is now that people have suffered so much human misery, there might be a little more willingness to permit honest discussion of the investing realities. That's my hope. I hope that's true. But, you know, I had to make a decision. My great crime is that I built this huge discussion board community at Motley Fool. It was the most successful board at that site. And I had responsibilities to these people. And I told them what the historical data says. And John made it clear can be that if I continued to report the number accurately, he would have me banned from that site. He would use his juice with Motley Fool to get me banned. And then after he got me banned at Motley Fool, he made clear he would use his juice to get me banned at Morningstar. And he did it. And he's not shy about it. You can read post where he says he's going to do just this and then follows it through. And he said he would use his juice to get smear reviews of my book at Amazon.com. So this all happened. But my question is, you know, if it were just John Graney, you could say, oh, it's some, you know, some outlier personality. It's, you know, John Graney has been endorsed by Motley Fool. Motley Fool said he should be named Poster of the Year. They put him up for Poster of the Year. The year he made death threats against anyone who posted honestly on safe withdrawal rates, they nominated him for poster of the year. And Mel Lindauer, same basic deal. You know, John Bogle, you know, shakes his hand, hugs him, says, hey, man, you're great. And Mel never stops his smear campaigns against anyone who posts honestly on safe withdrawal rates or on valuation-related topics at Vanguard Diehards or at Bogleheads. It's been lessened in recent months. It's been lessened since the price crash, but you still do see it. You still do see it. What's happened is the people who endorse passive investing, and I believe these people sincerely believe in passive investing, Mel and John and lots of others, Bogle obviously, lots of people, millions of people believe in it. That's not the issue. There's nothing wrong with people believing in passive investing. That's just, you know, that's healthy, having people having different points of view. What's not healthy is the dogmatism, but they're in a trap. What I'm trying to explain their behavior. I'm not trying to attack them. I'm telling you the facts because you need to know the facts to understand what I'm talking about. But I'm saying they're in a trap and we should let them out of the trap. And part of the trap is people need retirement advice, right? They've got to know what to do. You've got to answer the question, what is the safe withdrawal rate? But there's two possibilities. You can report it according to what passive investing says, which is one model of how stock investing works. Discredit it, in my opinion. But obviously some are not persuaded. Or you can give the answer under the rational model, which says valuations affect long-term returns. These are two different models. You follow one, which says the market's efficient. The market's efficient. Overvaluation is impossible. So you can follow passive investing and you just ignore valuations. It doesn't matter. Or you can follow rational investing and you say you have to look at valuations to calculate the retirement numbers. You got to do one or the other. It's two opposite paths. But once you choose your path, you had better hope that nobody challenges you, because if they challenge you, you might get sued. And the world we live in, what happened historically is that studies came out that appeared to support passive investing. Lots of them. And so large numbers of people went into that camp thinking it worked. Then studies came out that discredited those studies. And we all had to make a choice. Are we going to abandon the old model and go to the new one? Or are we going to stick with the old model? Well, there was a huge bull market going on at the time. So the old model was working just peachy as far as anyone could tell. People were raking it in. They didn't want to abandon that model. They said this model, you know, Taylor Larimore has this phrase. He says, you know, his retirement house is the house that Jack built. Following passive investing, let him pay for a house. He's not going to abandon that model. So he did it. You know, he talks about academic research, but Taylor Larimore is not a scientist, for heaven's sake. That's not even a criticism of him. It's just the most obvious observation. He's not a scientist. He's not practicing the scientific method. He likes to point to academic research because it makes it sound like his model works. But when the academic research goes the other way, he ignores it. He doesn't want to see it. He calls people trolls who point to the academic research that show his model doesn't work. They're trolls. Now, we've experienced the economic crisis. To get out of the economic crisis, we have to restore confidence in the markets. That means we have to explain to people what happened. What happened is we made a mistake. We thought passive investing worked. It doesn't work. It always leads to bone-crushing losses. If we just switch over to rational investing, we solve the problem. It all sounds so simple. But what are you going to do about the lawsuits? You know, if we all acknowledge tomorrow morning that passive investing can't work, there are going to be lawsuits. People are going to say, well, I put my retirement plan together based on this. You're going to pay me now? See, that's, you know, somebody asked Obama about abortion during the campaign. He says, that's above my pay grade. I steal from the best. You know, that's above my pay grade about what's going to happen with all these lawsuits. I can't answer the question. I can give you my take. I can give you my opinion, and I addressed it in an earlier podcast, but I think we need some kind of amnesty. I think we need to say, look, the people who advocated passive investing did it in good faith, and they can't be sued. Because I think that's what would open the door to them admitting that they were wrong, and once they admit they're wrong, we're off to the races. We're all rational investors, and we're all learning how investing works in the real world. So that's what I want to see happen. And I think, you know, I think that's the way we should take it. But of course, if you're one of the people who lost $1 million, the way you might look at it is they should have been able to get a mathematical calculation right. And I'm not so sure we should let people off the hook who engaged in abusive posting and that sort of thing. You know, these process questions, I think, are different, because the reason why I think it's different is the process questions make it impossible for it to us address the substance question is genuinely a mistake. You know, there's a lot of evidence pointing to that. Some people might say it's hard to believe that people so smart can make that mistake, but if the people were investing their own money, and clearly a lot of passive investing advocates were investing their own money, according to that theory, that shows to me that it was not, you know, it was not fraud, in that there was not bad intent. Without intent, it's not fraud. You know, in a legal sense. The practical effect, of course, is the same. The practical effect is that the person who followed the advice, you know, suffers a busted retirement, loses $1 million. But it wasn't intentional. And we're just going to have to understand that humans make mistakes. People believed in passive investing for perfectly good reasons. You know, it's in all the books. It's in all the magazines. I mean, there are academic studies. They didn't fall for it because they're dumb or bad. They fell for it for perfectly good reasons. But that has to change, you know. So what I say is we have to have an amnesty on the substance question. On the process question, I'm not so sure. On the process question, we need to change the way the internet is run so that people can post honestly and not live in fear that there's going to be a 7-year long smear campaign raised against them for doing so. That's an outrage. That has to stop. So there, I feel a little different now. You know, whether, you know, I don't think we want to hang people from a tree on that one either. If we can get people to take constructive steps, I think we should respond in charity. But if not, I think at some point there have to be consequences. You know, I'll explore that more in other podcasts. And I had a podcast where I looked at that a bit. It was called Investing Ethics and Oxymoron. And then there was an addendum to that. So if you listen to that one, be sure to listen to the next podcast, because I gave an addendum. But that's a hard issue. But my view is my view has been a 2-prong view. We have to be hard as nails on the honest posting question. We must get the prohibition on honest posting lifted. No ifs, ands, buts about it. It's degrading to post dishonestly because some goon threatens you. It's degrading. It's degrading to the goon. It's degrading to everyone. It's degrading to everyone who participates at such a board. A board at which honest posting is prohibited is a corrupt enterprise, in my view. No matter how much good information is generated, it's a corrupt enterprise. So that needs to change. But we need to be charitable and loving on the other questions. Because that's the only way we're going to heal these wounds. It's the only way we're going to move forward. But that's the situation we're in. So when you say, how could it be that we have, you know, that the studies haven't been corrected in 7 years, I think it's because of a fear of litigation. I don't say that's the only factor, but that's lurking. You know, Scott Burns, Dallas Morning News columnist, you know, he said to me, Rob, you've added a new layer to our understanding of safe withdrawal rates. That's obviously a compliment. But then he said, your approach is catastrophically unproductive. That's a strong statement. What did he mean? I think what he means is that I say that the old school studies are analytically invalid. In other words, there are a lot of people out there who are willing to say that counting valuations is okay, but they're not willing to say it's wrong not to. Why? In most areas of human endeavor, when we determine that something's wrong, we say it's wrong. That's how we move forward. We learn from our mistakes. But in this area, there's a deeply felt feeling that that would be a catastrophe to admit we were wrong. And I don't get it. But I think what's going on is that people feel if we admit we're wrong, we're opening ourselves up to lawsuits. So, fear of litigation has caused our economic crisis. We've got studies showing that valuations affect long-term returns. We've got common sense telling us it must be so. We've got historical data confirming what common sense tells us. We've got lots of experts willing to testify to this. But fear of litigation keeps us from admitting our mistakes. Fear of litigation caused our economic crisis. I'll close by quoting a few words from Robert Shiller's The Bible of Rational Investing, Irrational Exuberance. He says here, this is on page 204 of my copy, he sets this up by saying, it is a serious mistake for public figures to acquiesce in the stock market valuations we have seen recently. Think that's true? Think it was a mistake that our leaders didn't tell us? But what Shiller knew in 1996, that the valuation levels that applied from 1995 through 2008 were certain to bring on a huge economic crash. Think he's right? It is a serious mistake for public figures to acquiesce in the stock market valuations we have seen recently, to remain silent about the implications of such high valuations. I think he's right. I think it was a mistake. But here he explains a little bit why they don't do it. He says, of course, in the current political and economic climate, one incurs a substantial risk of embarrassment if one goes on record saying that stock market returns will be low or negative in coming years. Then he says, but an observer who remains silent about the unjustifiably high values because he or she could be wrong about the outlook is no better than a doctor who, having diagnosed high blood pressure in a patient, says nothing because the patient might be lucky and show no ill effects. You know, what he's saying there, he's saying we run a risk of embarrassment if we tell the truth about stock investing. It's worse than that. It's not just a risk of embarrassment. It's a risk of lawsuits. Mel Lindauer said, the reason why he sought a ban on honest posting on safe withdrawal rates is that it's dangerous for me to tell people that valuations affect long-term returns. It's dangerous for me to tell people that passive investing can never work in the real world. He says it's dangerous. Now, the doctor, if the doctor says, hey, you know, I think you have high blood pressure, he's not going to get sued for that. In other words, at least warning people about dangers, you can't get sued for that. That's being safe. That's being prudent. But in Investo world, you can get sued for being prudent. I never told anybody to take more risk than they were taking. I told them to take less. I told them the 4% safe withdrawal rate has only a 30% chance of working. There's a 70% chance your retirement's going to go bust. I was telling them be safe. I was saying don't retire early. Don't hand in a resignation from a high-paying job based on these crazy studies. I was saying, get your blood pressure checked. But in Investo world, you can get sued for that because people think it's dangerous to report what the historical data says accurately. So long as the bull market continues, so long as prices are high, it's dangerous. My hope is that now we've seen the consequences of living in denial of reality, we will start to see it's not dangerous to report the realities. We should encourage people to report the realities. If you have feedback, please contact me. I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at the Contact Rob button at the left side of every page of the website. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.